Welcome back, and thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time and your energy. Have I told you that the podcast is growing? We have about 50 new listeners each week this month, and I'm just so grateful. I didn't know what to expect when 1 year ago, this week, the podcast was launched. And I just thought, you know, it's going to impact at least one person, and that was okay with me. And now we have 2,000 listens to the 20 episodes that have been out so far, and this is the 21st episode. I'm really excited for you to hear all the amazingness from D.L. Stewart. I broke it into two parts, so you'll enjoy part one this week, and then look forward to part two coming out a week from now. And there's enough in there that if you're taking notes on your laptop or on a piece of paper, like our friend Dolan at UC Santa Barbara, who shared their notes with a very beautiful, was it a mermaid or a unicorn? They were just fantastic notes, Dolan. Great job sharing those with the world. You're really going to want to get out that pen or get to key clacking on that laptop, baby. So here's some things to look forward to, and I will get out of your way. The first thing is DL shares that the driving force of his work, what he calls the rudder of his work, is to create radically democratic spaces in higher education. Now, that isn't a profound enough statement. I really think that you need to listen in and hear what he has to say about that. The second thing that I'd like to highlight is that DL talks about how he arrived to the work he's doing today as a faculty from his earliest experiences as an undergraduate student activist. And I know that's a story for many of us, that was what brought us into this work, sort of this current that we rode in on in terms of being professionals and doing social justice work today. The third thing that I really pulled out that I know that is going to stick out in your mind as well is that DL shares a story about how he learned this early lesson as a new professional. And it was through an interaction with a student that woke him up to the work that he needed to do so that he wasn't putting the emotional labor of that work onto students. And it was a really beautiful story, and we were able to look in the rearview mirror. What would you have done differently? What would you have done the same now that you are who you are and you've learned what you've learned? Which is how a lot of us look back and we say, you know, we're different people now. We've learned and grown. So look forward to that. I think that's a really key piece of advice. And if you loved this episode, you know, head over to iTunes and leave a 5-star review. That helps other people to discover it. Thank you so much for all that you do. I'm glad that you're here. I'm glad that you continue to listen, and I look forward to connecting with you. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Resilient Campus Podcast, amplifying the voices of college inclusion innovators. I'm your host, Sabby Labor, founder and CEO of Resilient Campus. Join me each week as I interview professionals on the front lines of campus and community movement building. For more information, please visit resilientcampus.com/podcast. This is episode number 21 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today we're speaking with D.L. Stewart. D.L. is a scholar focusing on post-secondary education and issues of minoritization, transparent of a trans child, Violet's human, Capricorn, and over 40 Gen Xer. D.L., thanks so much for being with us today. I love that bio. It's so unique.
I wanted to do something that wasn't my standard boring professional bio.
So. Yeah, I love that you kind of queered the bio for us to right. really think about, like, why do we do bios in a particular way? So I love that. Thanks for your time and energy today. And I'm excited because before we got on this call, I mentioned that I had this epiphany about how being at this stage in the podcast, we're able to now interview people and elevate their voices who are connected to past participants who have been sharing their stories. And Bree Serrano was one of them who came on and talked about their experience and the mentorship and guidance that you provide for them in their pathway and their program. So I'm really honored to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here. It's neat to have that kind of loop there with Bree, having been on the podcast first, and first in a number of different ways, I guess, and to just have the opportunity to chat with you and share also with your listeners.
Awesome. So I know that was a fun and quirky like snapshot of
Right.
all the different hats you wear in life. Tell us
Yeah.
more about you. Who are you?
Sure. Yes. Who am I? Well, I think the who am I piece is really where I tried to focus my bio, sort of the being and not doing. So I'll take and go, what do I do? And what keeps me busy, kinds of things, the doing part of it. And so I am a full professor, so I'm an academic. Am currently at Colorado State University, where the other hat I wear is in administrative leadership for our student affairs and higher education programs here. And student affairs and higher education here at Colorado State is located in the School of Education and in the which is in the College of Health and Human Sciences here. And SAHE, so that's the acronym, SAHE. SAHE has a master's program that's offered in two modalities, both residential and online, and three, soon to be four, graduate certificates. We also offer three MOOC classes, so the Massive Open Online courses. So it's a pretty extensive enterprise with about 40 adjunct faculty who teach in the program. And I share leadership with Dr. Jen Johnson and also Dr. Pamela Graglia. So Jen and I are the co-coordinators, and then Dr. Graglia is the assistant coordinator for the unit. So that's a bit of what that's what my professional hats are. In my research and scholarship, I focus on issues of diversity and inclusion, minoritized students and their experiences and outcomes in institutions of higher education. Also use that those lenses to talk about institutional transformation centering around issues of equity and justice, and think about the role of higher ed, post-secondary education in society when those conversations come up. How do colleges and universities contribute or don't contribute to those conversations? And when they are contributing, how are they, what role are they playing as they do that? That's sort of like the, as I think about philosophy of higher ed and what its purpose is and what it's supposed to be about, or what it claims that it's about, is that piece of it. Yeah.
And can I say that what I've noticed is even when I was in my grad program, that my earliest recognition of your work, I became aware that you were really bridging that gap between the proclaimed or the professed goal and value and mission of higher education and how we serve students of color, queer and trans students, first generation low income. You were one of my earliest, when I was being socialized into the field of student affairs. And how to actually do this work in practice. I feel like you were my earliest exposure to someone who was bridging that in terms of the communities I was really interested in serving as well. So I appreciate, and I know you're being very humble about what you've accomplished, and I know that you're very well published and you write and you research prolifically. And so I just want to say thank you for the work that you do, because even in my earliest experiences as a graduate student, that was one of the guiding lights that helped me to see that what was possible in the field, even as someone surviving and thriving, was my guess at that time, and then someone that was contributing really meaningfully to how we bridge that gap. So
Wow.
thank you, and I know you're being
Thank
humble.
you. Well, thank you. It's gratifying to hear that, and humbling to hear that. So thanks a lot.
So DL, tell us which identities are most salient for you today. What's at top of mind?
So, and I think this is pretty consistent from day to day that I am a Black, queer, gender queered, trans man, with both neurological and psychiatric disabilities. So I identify as a disabled person. As you said in my bio earlier, that Gen Xer piece is also pretty salient for me. Often feel left out of generational conversations, sort of the ignored middle child that's trying to get attention, but no one wants to pay attention to. But really, those that first part, you know, being ADHD, bipolar, Black, queer, gender queer, trans man is really what informs my lens on the world.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And so let's talk about your lens and how you're applying that in the work that you're doing today. What are those issues or projects, initiatives? What's at top of mind for you in terms of what you're moving forward?
So I think it's the fault of my ADHD. I always have 50 million things going on, and that's also true now. I major project that I just finished looked at the experiences and supplemented with archival data of Black students that were in attended a set of small private liberal arts colleges in the North between 1945 and 1965, right? So really wanted to think about what that experience was like prior to civil rights legislation that broke the dam in terms of the matriculation of Black students and other students of color into predominantly white institutions throughout the country, right? So up to like 1964, 65, the vast majority of Black students who were able to go to college, so that's a small subset already, but the vast majority of those who were able to go to college typically went to historically Black colleges and universities. But there were many, who went to the North for school. And really wanted to get a grasp of what those experiences were like, to think about what integration and desegregation and segregation really mean and how they actually operate in campuses, on campuses. What does it mean to invite and admit students who are minoritized to your campus, but yet not be prepared for their presence, really? And looking at the ways that, so what are lessons that we can learn from, and that institutions should be learning from those, from that set of experiences to inform how we're talking about and moving forward with all these efforts to admit and encourage the persistence of undocumented students, of queer and trans students, right? Of these quote unquote new populations of minoritized students, which aren't new at all, but are, you know, in the limelight right now. And thinking about what all, how the past can inform the present and the future. So, since then, I've been writing a lot on and been invited to write a lot about institutions, higher education institutions, post-secondary institutions, and the role they play in shaping how students do or do not engage with critically, so through a critical theoretical paradigm, with issues of equity and justice. So I've been writing about that. I am writing now a book chapter with another younger scholar, more emerging scholar. I don't want to actually, because younger has implications around age, an emerging scholar about the experiences of, in the ways that people of color who are members of minoritized religious traditions. So, for example, Black Muslims, how they experience the intersection of racism and Christian hegemony, right, in their faith practices. Just have submitted to the publisher with Elisa Abis and Susan R. Jones a co-edited volume on that's looking at rethinking student development theory through critical perspectives. So I'm really excited about that. We've got such an amazing group of authors that are part of that text. And I think we are just really excited about what this could contribute to the field. Writing with another couple of colleagues here at CSU, some work on how we can rethink work and what work means in student affairs for student affairs practitioners, what it means to be the good worker. How does that come into play? How we talk about needing to recognize and manage our own reactions to and impact the way that we are impacted by what's happening in national political discourse and policy. How does that fall into, trying to be an effective worker and being seen as a good professional and a good worker? I am wanting to start a project on looking at the college search experiences and the college, college consideration. Think about college search, even from the considering that college could be for me through, students who are college bound and are, searching for colleges and trying to make decisions about college and whatnot. So that whole scope of college search for queer and trans students. What does that look like? What are the factors that are impacting their decisions and perhaps impacting their decisions in ways different from students who are not queer and trans, and further enhancing college choice decision models that we have in the field in higher ed.
You really weren't kidding when you said you had a lot of projects going on.
Right. I think that's everything right now. The other thing that I just had the opportunity with a couple of colleagues who are at the University of Colorado at Boulder, an initiative that they have founded and is supported through the College of Education there called a Queer Endeavor. And the work that they are doing around trying to engage community and working with them on engaging scholars with community members, with queer and trans youth and their families, with K through 12 educators, with community service providers to really inform what the research agenda, in a sense, needs to be. Think about queer and trans people, not just within the field of higher education either, but broadly. So that did a first town hall, bringing those groups together up in Boulder, as part of a Queer Endeavors Institute, just a couple of weeks ago. And it was really, really powerful and a really rich discussion.
That's
So,
wonderful.
yeah.
So,
I think I made myself tired, trying to go through all that.
yeah, it sounds tiring just listing it out, huh? And tell me a little bit of, is there a system or a way that you organize the research questions and the topics that you're interested in for folks that are listening to the podcast that might also be interested in a multitude of identities and and just have a lot of projects that they want to start potentially, but they don't. Is there a system for you or some way that you organize which projects you say yes to or which research questions keep showing up for you?
So yeah, it's I think about so what's at the center? What's the rudder, right? Is another way to think about it that is driving me, this pushing the direction that I want to go in. And that rudder for me is wanting to positively affect the ways that institutions of post-secondary education affect the experiences and lives of minoritized students in college, right? Such that higher education becomes a more radically democratic space. That's the rudder. And so things that fit within that rudder for me, that are aligned with that rudder are what I say yes to. And then there are people I don't say no to, right? Because, it's this person who asked, and so yes, I'm going to say yes, even if I feel like I really don't have the capacity to do it. I find a way to make it happen. But even with that, it's because it still falls in line with trying to drive toward that goal. And so in the end, I hope that, the 17 years of research and scholarship that I've done and been a part of, and most importantly, the participants who have been willing to share their lives and their insights with me are helping to contribute to actively contribute to making post-secondary education, particularly in the United States, a far more radically democratic space. That's the hope. And I recognize that I won't necessarily know whether I've accomplished that within the course, the time span of my own career, and maybe not even in the time span of my own life. I have no idea that I'll be able to detect that, because that's a long-term game to play.
How do you maintain your energy throughout that and not get burned out?
For me, it's hearing what you shared earlier about how my work impacted you in your practice and your orientation to the work. It's hearing that. It's hearing from people who said, we are using, such and such article or essay to totally rethink how we're doing X. It's having people after presentations I do at conferences say, wow, you made me totally rethink. And now I'm going to go back to my campus and we're going to look at how we do this policy differently. It's getting those things. It's getting those moments of affirmation, and through that being like, okay, people are actually reading it. It's actually helping. Things are perhaps changing, even within small circles, but enough ripples in the water, right, can make significant change. So you get
Absolutely.
enough small ripples, you can create a wave, right? And I think that it's when I have those moments that it's like, okay, I'm not just out here, talking to the wind.
Yeah, when you said that you were working with Abbess and Jones on a critical lens applied to student development theory, I got really excited because what you're contributing to will provide that ripple effect in terms of what graduate programs have as available resources. I'm really excited about the wave that you can create with a few programs adopting it and then many programs and sort of building that trend from there. So, Deal, tell us about how you arrived to the work that you're doing today. What brought you to this point?
When I get this question, I often say that it originated really by being a Black kid growing up in Harlem in New York City. And that experience was brought with me into college. I attended Kalamazoo College. And during my 4 years at Kalamazoo, just got really sensitized to the many different ways that, particularly within the sphere of race, that equity and justice were not really part of the conversation, and even the ways that diversity and inclusion were being thwarted, even as they were being used to highlight, look how good we're doing, kind of thing. I was an active student leader at Kalamazoo, a member of our Black student organization, was part of a founding, one of the founding members of a drama troupe that sought to educate and expand awareness about Black people and history and culture in the US and its connections to Africa. So I was engaged in a lot of that kind of work as a student, I guess now I probably would have been labeled as a student activist. That language wasn't really used a lot back then in the way that it is now. And that informed how I engaged. So I went directly into a student affairs position right after undergrad at another small private liberal arts college. And I worked in multicultural affairs. And so during the time that I was there, again, had my lens widen. My acceptance remarks at Creating Change this year, I talked about a student who was a Black student, a genderqueer student, non-binary, who challenged me once. And there was the Take Back the Night march was going to happen, and the student asked me if I was going to attend because they were, I'm going to be speaking. I'd love for you to attend. And I think I kind of equivocated on whether or not I'd be able to make it or something. And I was not out as queer or trans at this point. I came to acknowledge and accept those aspects of my identity and my being in my mid-30s and forward. So the student, when they heard me say that, they were like, and they knew I was bullshitting. They challenged me and said, if you're going to be here to support students of color, and on this campus, students of color were really ma overwhelming majority of students of color were Black students. If you're going to be here and support us, you need to be supporting all of us, not just some of us. And so that's, includes queer and transgender students. And I sat with that for a while, and I was like, whoa, that okay. And that was challenging everything I had been brought up with in terms of religion. I was raised in a Christian household, a very Black evangelical, charismatic, kind of Pentecostal oriented household. And that was like not anything I had been at that point raised to embrace. And so I had a moment of internal struggle where I really had to be like, oh, okay, what am I about? Am I going to be here for all of these students of color? And so it was really also a recognition of needing to incorporate a much more intersectional perspective in my practice and my philosophy, of needing to recognize the both and of racism and heterosexism and cissexism. I didn't know that language was cissexism at the time, but it was all about, being, anti-queer was just the umbrella. And even having to get used to using the word queer, because the orientation in my head at that point was that queer was a slur, that you should not use to refer to people, but the queer and trans students at Kenyon use queer. That was the language they used to self name and identify. So it was a lot of growth, a lot of growth, a lot of really good growth that came at the hand of the students that I was supposed to be serving. And so recognizing that they were doing labor for me that they shouldn't have had to do. That was my labor to be doing. But they were generous enough and invested enough in their own campus and trying to make that campus a better place that they stepped up to check me, which they didn't have to do. And it really wasn't their job. It was not their responsibility to do that. But I'm so appreciative that they did. So yeah, to go back to the story, I went to the Take Back the Night march, and I listened to this student share their story and share their pain of being sort of exiled, sort of being nowhere, everywhere and nowhere, of being not having their Blackness not seen in the very predominantly white queer community at the college at the time. And also being sort of unseen and invisibilized by the Black community because of their queerness. And it was a gut punch. It was a gut punch. And I was like, I can't stand on the sidelines and try to play this, distant. Yeah, I support you, but I'm not going to be down with what you're down with. I was like, nah, it's time out for that.
Tell me about that moment that, so you mentioned that it's a gut punch, it was emotional labor that the students were doing. Tell us about that, how you grew from that moment.
Sure. And it's interesting because I said I came into this position straight out of undergrad. So when I started in the role, I was 21, and there were students who were the same age I was, or within 3 years of me, right? And I turned 22 during that year there, but still, in a sense, this helped me because I was dealing really with age cohort peers, even though my professional status was different. And I think because I was so new and I was so young, I didn't know yet that I was supposed to be all this, I'm an administrator, you're a student. Who are you to tell me this kind of thing? I didn't know that I was supposed to do that, right? And so I didn't. And I think that's one of the things I did right in that was being willing to listen. And even as I have progressed in my career and become a faculty member, I've worked really hard to not allow that hierarchical separation to cause me to dismiss what students are telling me. So I've tried really hard to hold on to that. And I don't want to assume that I've always been successful because I think, people get defensive. And that defensiveness, I think, sometimes comes from, well, I'm trying to do good. I'm trying, I'm on your side. This attitude, I'm on your side. I'm trying to help. And you're coming at me with all of this challenge. And the defenses go up, which I think is an understandable human reaction, for one thing. And at the same time, it doesn't help move the conversation forward. Looking back, if I were to do that again, and that's hard. It's like I'm not the same person I was when that happened. And so there's a ton of things I would do differently now, because I know more and I have better, I'm not so worried about, queer by association issues as I was then. I have read more. I have engaged different kinds of perspectives. I am listening to other people in ways that have been made possible, particularly through social media, that like did not exist back then. Literally did not exist. Not these kinds of faith. There was no Facebook. There was no Twitter. There was no Instagram. There were IRC chat rooms. And some of your listeners that are old enough will know what IRC chat room may remember IRC chat rooms. That was it. If that situation happened today, I absolutely would hopefully not, first of all, be so completely naive and ignorant as I was then about the issue. But I know there are some things that I am absolutely naive and ignorant about and still learning about. And what I try to do is listen, is just listen really closely and not make it about me, but keep the student centered and what they need and what the institutional system that I'm a part of is failing, how it's failing. And because I'm a part of that system, yes, I'm a part of that failure. So what should I be doing to counter that? That's the kind of attitude that I wish I would come with now if that same situation happened. Because what I didn't come with it then. I came with it from a very personal, I failed. I am a bad person. I am not living up to my values. And so it was personal. It was a personal shame that I experienced. And that's where the gut punch was. And that is like, okay, you deal with your own personal mess on your own time. That's not what is necessary in this moment. I don't, you don't need to bleed all over the students. go home and bleed and deal with your stuff there. But in this moment, we need you to show up in this kind of way. So, yeah, I think that's what I would hope would I would lead with now.
Thanks for listening to part one of our interview with DL Stewart. Look forward to the second half of this interview next week. I hope that you enjoyed it and look forward to more from DL. Thanks so much for tuning in. Head on over to iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss out on a single episode.